Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One from Eagle Speak. Thank you very much for taking time today to join us for another live edition of Midrats. And for those in the esteemed company of our live listeners, if you'd like to, while you're on the show page, if you scroll down near the bottom, you'll see an opportunity to join the chat room. If during the course of the show you'd like to share your observations live with your fellow listeners, or if there are some questions you'd like for us to address to our guest, that's a great place to put it. We'll be monitoring it during the course of the show, and we'd be honored to bring your great ideas into the conversation for the next hour. And if you got to take off and take care of some business, you want to catch up on what you missed, you can get the full archive over at Blog Talk Radio, or you can take a shortcut and just subscribe to the free podcast over on iTunes and Stitcher. But let's go ahead and dive into the show. We saw in the last week the release of the reports. We had both the memorandum and, of course, the comprehensive review that went over the summer collisions of the USS Fitzgerald and USS McCain over in Westpac. These collisions resulted in the death of 17 sailors and the removal from a very important theater of operations, two of the most critical assets, its Arleigh Burke-class destroyers. And in the week that we've been able to look at the report, it's shed some light on a few areas that people have been presuming. And there have been some discussions in the interim, both on the Hill and in the media, about the circumstances that may have contributed to these collisions. And we have on today a returning guest to discuss all the direct and latent issues that we know so far with regard to the collisions. We're bringing on Brian McGrath, Commander, USN retired. He is the Assistant Director of the Hudson Institute Center for American Sea Power, and he is the managing director of the Ferry Bridge Group, LLC, a small defense consulting firm. Brian, welcome back to Midrats.
Great to be here. I hope someday to have a term applied to me like Eagle Speak has, or Eagle One has, the ever genial. I think that's a great thing to be.
A good thing to aspire to. I think you just need a couple more decades of seasoning and we'll get there.
Ouch.
wizened and wise and genial, yes. It's that North Carolina Andy Griffith vibe. I think it's something in the water. Brian, to kick things off, I thought maybe we should just do a scene setter because the Fitzgerald and McCain collisions, and I think when the first news came in about the Fitzgerald collision, you and I had a little back and forth on Twitter before we even realized the extent of the damage that type of bulbous bow on a merchant ship could do. But it came on what had been a very, very tough year from a seamanship point of view in Westpac, and not just because of the McCain and the Fitzgerald, but things that happened earlier. We've really seen a lot of movement in the Navy to try to look at what's happening. And if you could, for the listener, just kind of outline the context of what we've seen from a seamanship point of view in Westpac this year.
Yeah, the two collisions of the summer were the sort of attention-grabbing accidents in what was elsewhere a pretty fertile year for surface warfare seamanship problems in the Western Pacific. There was a grounding cruiser, Antietam, CG-54 grounded outside of Tokyo Bay or in Tokyo Bay in January, causing some damage to that ship that has to be fixed. And then Lake Champlain a few months later, I think in May, had a collision with a North Korean fishing vessel. I don't believe anyone was killed in that accident. So when the Fitzgerald had its collision in June, in which seven sailors died, there was an immediate sense that from virtually anybody who follows these things that, wow, there's something going on out there. And when McCain had its collision 6 or 8 weeks later, those feelings got even stronger. And so in addition to the accident, the investigations that are required both by the Navy's justice system and by admiralty courts that have gone into the individual looks at these four separate events, there was also a 60-day review that was done under the leadership of Admiral Davidson, the Fleet Forces Commander, that seeks to investigate the potential for broad systemic causes. What ties these four incidents together, and what actions needed to be taken? And that was one of the comprehensive review, as it was called, was the meatiest part of what was released this week by the Navy, in addition to sanitized collision reports on the Fitzgerald and McCain.
Yeah, there were a lot of. I saw the CNO's press conference that he held, and he listed several things that were specific to these incidents, but he also said, and I thought this was really interesting, that over a sustained period of time, rising pressures and operational demands led those in command to rationalize declining standards in fundamental seamanship and watchstanding skills, teamwork, operational safety assessment, and the professional culture. This resulted in a reduction of operational safety standards. That's a pretty large indictment of what became, I guess, kind of we're so busy that we don't have time to do the training. Is that kind of what you heard when you listened to that conference?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I will lay out a theory probably during the course of this podcast that I think rather consistently held to for the last couple of months. And it was, I think, at least partially reinforced by what was released this week. And it's a relatively unpopular view because it's unsatisfying, and to some extent it swims upstream against our society's not inability, but its distaste for assigning actual human responsibility when we can share it and diffuse it. Here's my theory. There were in the Western Pacific, in four deployed naval forces, deep, persistent readiness problems that were developing over the course of, I would say, the last 3 years. Those readiness problems were a function of a significantly increased operational demand placed on a static force that got no larger to meet those demands. When you mix in a culture of mission responsiveness that says we'll get the job done, that culture created a series of what were essentially risk management techniques, which looked at, all right, this force is required to maintain a certain standard of readiness. That standard of readiness is measured by a series of certifications in the requisite mission areas and skills that we require these ships to be responsible for. There's something like 20 or 22 separate mission areas. Over time, and that readiness is demonstrated by a certification which goes into that is administrative, that is personnel, that is materiel, and that is actual operational performance. And so bound up in that certification is a whole series of things that must be demonstrated. You have to have these pubs, you may have to have these charts, you have to have these people with these skills, you have to have this equipment working, and then you have to demonstrate these certain evolutions. And when you fully demonstrate that package of things, you get a certification for that mission area. And so what happened over time was that the authorities in place began to look at these certifications and say, well, yeah, the ship isn't certified in this mission area, but the reason it isn't certified in this mission area is really pretty unimportant, and so we can mitigate the risk by, you know, certainly by identifying, first of all, what the deficit in that certification was, and identifying a path to its eventual certification. And these were these risk assessment management processes or ramps that were created in the Western Pacific. And the problem was that over time, the recourse to these risk mitigation strategies became more of the rule than the exception. And so you had ships go from basically 7% of their certifications being waivered in 2014 to being nearly 40%, 37% in 2017. And that's a dramatic increase. So when the CNO talks about normalizing a lower standard, that's what he's talking about. He's talking about the fleet in place looking at having a standard and then saying, well, we're not going to get any more ships. We're not going to get any less mission area or mission requirements. We need to look at how we manage risk, and we're going to lower that. So this, apart from the four accidents and apart from the 17 dead sailors, this is a problem. This is a huge problem, and it's a problem essentially of supply and demand and resources. And it would have had to be solved in order for the Navy to claim readiness for anything, for battle, for operations in the Western Pacific. Readiness clearly declined. Then we get these four accidents, and I tend to deal primarily with the ones where humans died. That may be me dismissing other important data points. But I look at the accidents on McCain and Fitzgerald, try to tie them to these broader readiness problems. And I have a much more difficult time doing that than others do. I believe the CNO walked a very fine line in his news conference I think quite rightly affixing responsibility for the accidents on the ships. But then there was a good deal of pointing at these broader systemic problems as contributory. And so where I come down on this is that to the extent that the broad readiness problems and this lowering of standards in the FDNF contributed to these collisions, it was in the degradation of secondary mechanisms for preventing these tragedies. The reason these ships collided is that people made decisions that were ultimately proven to be bad decisions that at the time, at least one of them knew was a bad decision. The officer of the deck on the Fitzgerald repeatedly failed to call the captain at times when that officer knew and others on the bridge knew it was required to do so. That's not Seventh Fleet's fault. That's not Pac Fleet's fault, Surf Force's fault. It's not anyone's fault except that officer and potentially the commanding officer for not setting up an atmosphere on that ship in which that officer felt that doing so was required. This commanding officer, the McCain, made a decision the day before that collision not to put the highest state of readiness in force at the time when the ship's navigational situation required the highest state of readiness. He made that decision against the recommendation of his executive officer, the operations officer, and the navigator. And then there were a series of events that went into action that led to the collision that had the captain not made that decision the day before, it seems logical to infer there would have been no collision. So I think both things existed. There were culpably negligent ships, and there was a system that was broken. It's just very difficult for me to make that direct and satisfying connected dot line from one to the other. I know in my heart that they are related, but as a matter of law and as a matter of logic, I can't make that connection. I can only say that they were related and influenced. I can't say one was the cause of the other.
Yeah, I share your frustration because it's really hard, and I had to stop, as I think all naval officers had, and read again that almost otherworldly idea that an officer of the deck could so consistently, and maybe we'll find out more about the ship's climate and things that happen otherwise, but to so completely ignore CO standing orders like that and then kind of improvise along the way. And I, in many ways, I feel sorry for that entire bridge team. Being that type of environment.
Yeah.
And I mean, you brought up a good point, and it's something that I think, and you know, as different people are trying to address a good lessons learned here, one thing that we should be proud of in our Navy is we do have a culture of responsibility. In good times and bad, fair or not, it's unquestionably a net positive. And we've seen that here. And backing up a little bit on that, though, when we look at the direct causes, which and we'll revisit a couple of those that you mentioned there, especially the CO of the McCain, again, later on in the show, I have a question specifically on that. If you get back past those initial causes, and there is something in the background, and you mentioned it, that, you know, are there latent causes, if not Navy-wide, if not service community-wide, in Westpac on FDF that didn't just exist in 2017, that have been around for a while? And in a culture responsibility, as we execute it, often is just a snapshot, almost a musical chair situation. Well, the music has stopped and you're holding it. Congratulations. And perhaps the process we're going through is something akin to that. But when you look at the framework behind, in political venues, you saw in South Africa, a Truth and Reconciliation Committee that looked back, very, very abrupt, very direct, very much multiple layer accountable for decisions, not just the person who pulled the trigger, but who issued the order, who created the environment to do it, the whole nine yards. Is that something that we might be able to look at bringing into this discussion to get to build a more comprehensive review, if nothing else, how you mentioned the ramps, the risk assessment mitigation plans, how that morphed into what it did to find a result in it? Because I think if we just get the check in the block on accountability and a snapshot, we may not learn all we need to learn.
Well, I think, first of all, I agree with you on the goodness of the accountability culture in the Navy. I think what we saw this week, though, was that accountability culture in action, right? So we have I believe a system that, especially at in the Navy, that assigns the commanding officer a unique place in organization of the U.S. military. I don't know of another position in the military where authority, accountability, and responsibility are wrapped up so completely in one person. And we do that. We do that in no small measure because that person is in the best position of anyone to understand both the capabilities of and weaknesses of his or her own ship and the policies, procedures, and atmosphere that produces and supports him on the outside. Everybody, you know, looks to they want to see admirals' heads, you know, rolling and blood in the scuppers, and we got plenty of that in this. A lot of people lost their jobs or being retired early, but we, the U.S. Navy, you, me, and Sal, and you, me, and Eagle One, and everybody else who ever did this, we all lived under this regime in which we knew that the captain was treated differently than all of the rest of us. And I think that kind of responsibility is just so different than we see anywhere else in American society. And it's almost like American society looks at us. I use this metaphor all the time. It's like zoo animals. I mean, they look at us there, they appreciate us, but they don't want to be down there with us they don't want to be down there in the zoo. They recognize that that's a different place, and this level of responsibility, it's exacting, it's cold, and it is difficult for most people to grasp. But you didn't just see that this week. You saw the entire organization taking responsibility. That comprehensive report is brutal. It's absolutely brutal on the organized, train, equip, and operate functions of the U.S. Navy. It was brutal on how the ships were manned. It was brutal on how they were supported technically by the radar systems and the lack of quality navigation systems and radars on those ships. It was brutal on the training. It was brutal on the personal qualification. It was brutal on the system that produces junior officers. It was brutal on the system that produces skilled enlisted people. So I'm satisfied that the problem is being worked in the manner that it should, which is really from both ends, right? I mean, the system of producing readiness failed in the Seventh Fleet, and it must change, and it must be addressed, and that comprehensive report gives us a lot to go on there. Those four ships failed. They failed rather obviously when you read the reports of them. And as I sit here, and I hope your listeners are saying, well, isn't four in 1 year a lot? Yeah, four in 1 year is a lot. 17 people is a 17 dead sailors is a terrible thing. The suggestion that there might be something wrong out there, I think, is a very logical one. And I think if you cannot prove it conclusively, it's probably best to just assume it and then go forward with the recommendations or the direction that is in that comprehensive review. There is a lot of work to do to address those things. Now, the question is, do these deficits exist elsewhere? Or is what we see in the Seventh Fleet a function of the unique circumstances that are there, a unique readiness production model, a uniquely pressurized operational environment? I think the Secretary of the Navy's he has his own inquiry into these subjects, which I think will probably look more broadly across the Navy than this one did. This is one of the disappointments I had in in the comprehensive review, because I'm not satisfied that they were able to look across the Navy. My gut tells me that across the Navy, they're going to find, if they look readiness, they're going to find, they're going to be very unsatisfied with what they see, because they're going to see that when a ship comes out of the shipyard after its 3-month CNO availability, it has 8 months essentially under the fleet readiness plan that we use for the ships that aren't forward deployed. It has 8 months of time to get itself together through the regular maintenance, regular training. That 8 months doesn't exist for the ships in the FDNF. But the ships, you know, in Norfolk and San Diego, if you gave them that musical chairs assessment 3 months after they got out of the shipyard, you'd find that they have dramatically lower readiness than the average ship has in the FDNF. And that's because all their certifications go back to zero when they go into come out of the CNO availability. But they have a system in place that gradually builds readiness, competence, professionalism, and warfighting skills. It's an assembly line that leads at the end of the assembly line to a strike group that then goes forward in a magnificently ready way. So if you measure the readiness of those ships just before they deploy, you would find that the readiness of the average ship there is higher than what you get in the FDNF. So we're going to find differing values from the readiness of the ships. Now, I think at an even higher level than that, the surface force, and this is something that Admiral Roden talked about at Surface Navy Association in the past in his speeches, about how the surface Navy has, you know, since the end of the Cold War, it lost the spring in its step, and it mostly manifested itself in, you know, kind of getting losing the anti-surface warfare mission, having our ASW proficiency go down. There was a decline in the professionalism that we saw cataloged in the Belisle report in 2010. Nobody would argue that that surface force professionalism had some problems with it across the force. I think what was happening, though, was that a lot of the changes and a lot of the stuff that was going to address that professionalism just hadn't kicked in yet. It takes a while you put something in the 14 budget, it takes a few years to start to kick over. And so you've got a lot of investments that were made, and this comprehensive report points to these things, but they just haven't happened yet. And I think over time, and with now this added emphasis, a subject that needed attention, surface warfare professionalism and readiness, is going to get what it needs.
Well, you've served on the DDG, and of course my qualifications on these ships goes back to the days when we had engine order telegraphs and a ship's wheel instead of a whatever they have now, a knob to change course. Is it possible that by relying so much on technology that we've gotten away from people applying common sense to the situations they're in? Is that also more specific to the people involved rather than or the training than to the technology itself?
Well, I mean, let's face it. We had some pretty ugly disasters in the days of synchros and servos in our steering systems, and in the days of standalone surface search radars, where you just have a display on the bridge. Going to sea has always been a dangerous business, and we went through a period from, I think, 1974 or 75 to very recently, where we didn't kill anybody in collisions. But you know, you go back and look at I think it was the was it the Melbourne Evans incident? Then you had in 1954. Then you had the collisions in the 70s. You had these things happening when we had simplicity. But what I would say to you is that we have indeed increased technology, but we haven't, especially in the technology that serves BridgeWatt standards, we haven't done what's necessary to integrate that technology in a way that serves the watch standard. All we've done, in my view, is add systems, in many cases unintegrated systems, that just add to the total amount of information that, you know, last year's college graduate has to deal with on the bridge. And until we begin to look at the bridge as a system, the way we look at CIC as a system, and begin to integrate all of these inputs and create decision management tools that help the human, they're going to have a much more difficult time in what has become a far more difficult maritime environment. The CNO says, the CNO's data that he uses is that the volume of traffic on the Earth's oceans has increased 400% since he came in the Navy in 1982. It's beyond argument that it is tougher today in the Strait of Malacca than it was 40 years ago. And if all you get in the Strait of Malacca is more information into your little pea brain, and it's not integrated information, it's not correlated information, it's not a thing that says, this is what's going on, and this is what I, the computer, recommend you do in this part, at this point, we're just gonna overwhelm people. We can increase training, but I think we really need to do a better job of increasing training and increasing the degree to which the technology serves the people.
Last time I was in San Diego, I did my usual walk around, ask questions, and play stupid, which is pretty easy for me to do. And I grabbed a couple of surface JOs. One was from one of the small boat static displays they had there. And one of the questions I ask them, hey, from either a material or a personnel point of view, you know, what's the one thing you wish you had that you don't have? And I got the same answer from both of them. It's like, I want my sailors to show up qualified as opposed to coming here, filling up a billet and then disappearing for months on end because, yeah, I got my EN1 fill, but he has no experience in my plant, so he's got to go get trained. And when we looked at the McCain on board and on watch up on the bridge, you had people who were TAD from the Antietam that evidently were not qualified because a bridge is a bridge, is a system isn't a system. And talk a little bit about at least what we know so far over at the forward deployed naval forces about the training of the personnel involved in the incident, the overall manning situation of the ships, and how that might have been a contributing factor to the whole series of events that took place.
Well, you bring up one of them. The steering system on the McCain, steering and engine control system on the McCain, is different even than I had on my DDG. And it was certainly different from what the sailor who was operating it had on the Antietam. And I think there the reports raise some questions about the qualification of that sailor to operate that steering system. And if that sailor was not qualified, or if his or her qualification was dubious in its patrilineage, obviously the chain of command is going to have to answer for that in legal proceedings. You can never get – you don't need to go to school to learn how to operate the helm unit on a modern destroyer. You have to do the fundamentals – of the qualification standard. You have to stand watches. You may have to, you know, have a board. The bottom line is you have to do the work. You have to do the work, the repetition, stand the watches under instruction, do the loss of steering drills, go through the routine evolutions where you pull out the procedure and you shift steering, you split out or ungang, as they refer to it in the report, the steering from the engine control. You switch the whole shoot and match to a secondary station. This is the jot and tittle of what good ships do. You have to constantly be practicing. There's no such thing as boredom, and you can't allow it as a commanding officer. You cannot allow boredom. You have to insist that there's always something going on. That the person standing on the helm unit at 5:22 in the morning when McCain collided was potentially unqualified to be standing there is a terrible thing, and it is part of the responsibility that the commanding officer bears for that tragedy. There are clearly situations on the ships where we want people to show up a full up round. They show up, you know, they have qualified on their watch, and then they get to the ship and they know everything about what they need to do. That's where we'd like to go. I hate to bring up the LCS on the show with you, Sal, but I think that's what the LCS training pipeline does. Is it by building these sort of magnificent shore training facilities, they provide people to the ships who are considerably more qualified than the average person showing up on a DDG. I think that's the way they do it. I don't know for sure. Maybe somebody listening can help with that. But what you get on the steering unit, though, is that's an OJT. That's just something. That's what you do. You train your relief. You train the next guy. You train the next girl. And that didn't appear to happen on the McCain. And more importantly, there shouldn't have been a helmsman on at that point. There should have been a master helmsman because the scene anchor detail should have been set. Now, if the master helmsman wasn't qualified, that's a whole different kettle of fish. But I do agree with you that Valhalla is to have everybody show up on your ship qualified fully for what you want them to do. I would like to get closer to that, but I think the expense associated with a training establishment that takes all of that off the backs of the ships is unlikely to be affordable.
Yeah, since both my sons are naval aviators, I can tell you they don't spare any expense in getting those guys ready before they put them in a cockpit. Not much in the way of OJT before you go flying. But that reminds me that Sal and I think Herbal raised the issue of the way the aviation community addresses safety. And one of those is that they have safety officers. They do near mishap reports. I mean, stuff that I don't ever remember seeing in the surface Navy. And especially since one of these ships, I think it was the Fitzgerald, had a previous very close call. You know, is there a need to increase the role of the safety officer assigned to these ships to make, you know, to help lessons learned out of really close calls so these things don't happen again?
You know, I think that's a reasonable assumption. There is in naval aviation a tremendous culture of safety. This is when it comes right down to it, because we don't want our airplanes falling out of the sky and killing our aviators. There is a difference in the degree to which safety has an immediate impact in aviation and surface force. And so the surface force has over time assumed a level of risk that would be entirely unacceptable in the aviation community. I think there's something to beefing up the safety officer or the role of the safety officer in the surface force. Number one. Number two, this near miss report thing is something that when I first heard about it, which was quite frankly just after the Fitzgerald collision, I didn't know that it even existed. It immediately struck me as a straightforward and fairly common sense thing. I believe the surface force has made them required now it will be interesting to see the culture. I mean, now that you've required them, you damn sure better be accepting of them. So when a ship sends one in, it can't mean you come down like a ton of bricks on that ship and on that commanding officer. It's got to be more of a thank you for this. How can we help? And we really mean help. We could, is there some training we can help you with? Is there some people? You know, it's got to be that kind of an environment rather than one that holds it against people. And I would like to think that that's what happens. I'd like to see that.
Kind of moving up a little bit to an operational concern, wanted to get a read from you, is, you know, the whole ramp program, and you rightfully outlined the high tempo, high profile environment that we have in Westpac right now, China, North Korea, et cetera. And a lot of those were done for the purpose to make sure that you had enough assets forward. And you've been one of the people for a while who has been at the front of talking about the need for a larger Navy, not just so we can meet our requirements, but that we have a little leeway so people aren't doing 9-month deployments, or you can backfill if there's an unexpected incident. And because of this, we've had two of our major combatants in that forward area are out of action for a long period of time. And I think this year has brought two things into relief. One is our inability to backfill when you have unexpected losses. And also pulling the thread on that is, if we've identified all these issues, both direct and latent, when it comes to everyday sea keeping, should it also highlight a concern on our part about our warfighting ability? If we can't do the basics of seamanship, how much confidence do we have in our basics of warfighting ability? And is that a thread, probably on the classified side of the house, that we would hope our Navy is pulling pretty hard on?
Well, you know, again, those mission areas, a good number of them are core mission areas, right? You've got integrated air and maritime missile defense, AAW, ASW. The first thing I want to say, though, is one mission area in which both of these ships excelled is damage control. You cannot possibly tell me that these ships weren't ready and then explain to me how they saved themselves. I read those reports. I know you did too. I saw not only heroism, but I saw absolutely superb, professional, well-trained damage control crews going out and saving their ships. So I'd like to think that the surface force is capable of bringing that kind of attention to detail and performance across the spectrum. The problem is you can't do it. You can't do it solely on your own. You need you need external training. You need some time. You need the professional training teams that the surface force has provided for. You need them to come to your ship and ride you and do drills. When you look at the risk mitigation plans that were in place, it seems to me reasonable to infer that the sort of basic warfighting readiness among the ships in the FDNF probably declined. And I'm not willing to say, well, the ramps just point out that it's just this and that is tertiary causes, that they don't have their certifications. I think a fully certified ship is probably all in all better than the same ship with partial certifications. I think it's hard to argue that. It seems to me that we have now the impetus to go out and properly resource and create the time for where the ships can actually do the training time they need to get their certifications. But what's really important to me, everybody wants a silver bullet solution on these board readiness. There are no silver bullet solutions, but there is one thing that I believe would have a more impact than anything else in surface force readiness in the Western Pacific, and that would be to create the bandwidth at the immediate superior in command, the ISIC, whether it's Destroyer Squadron 15 or this new surface group, Western Pacific, to send senior experts out on these ships on a regular basis to assess readiness and performance between these certification periods, to be able to say, hey, you know, I recognize that 9 months ago you earned your certification in AAW, but you suck. What I see today, and I'm a commander or a captain, what I see is that you are uncertified, and I'm taking your certification from you, and here is the plan that we're going to do together to get you back to a certified station. We have cut out that level of oversight. With our mania to reduce staff sizes, we have sufficient numbers of people to come on board these ships and do these grand certification events. But what we don't have is the ability to check up on them. We've completely shifted that responsibility to the individual commanding officer. And quite frankly, I would like there to be a more intrusive level of command above that, that comes down, you know, every 3 to 6 months and says, show me how good you are. And then there are consequences to not being as good as you said you were, or that as good as you should be. And those consequences are you have to get trained back up again. I'd like to see that.
In addition to those spot checks, which I want to call spot checks, how much effort should be put into developing some kind of simulators for our young officers to and maybe even our COs to put them in the positions where these kinds of events, I mean, they do it with aircraft guys, you know, your right engine just went out, whatever. Why shouldn't we be developing really good simulators for these, for surface warfare people?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I hate to break it to you, Eagle One, but there is a pecking order in the Navy when it comes to resource allocation.
I've never heard that before.
Yeah. Things that boil water with nuclear power come first. They're in position one. Things that fall out of the sky are in position 1A. Surface ships are in like position 6. And so the amount of money allocated to high fidelity trainers in the surface force is not up to the amount of money that I think you and I both believe would be useful. Now, that doesn't mean that we haven't allocated a considerable amount of money to that the surface force hasn't worked very hard to increase the fidelity of its trainers, which it has. If you look at what's out there, what's up at SWAS in Newport, primarily, and compare that to what was up there 10 years ago, it is so much better than what used to be there. It's not good enough, though. It's not stressful enough. Ship crews should be able to, I mean, we ought to be able to put a bridge team and a CIC team in a trainer that is a Strait of Malacca at 5 o'clock in the morning on August, whatever date it was, August 21st or August 20th, and run that scenario and show and have these bridge teams before they ever go out there. You never want a watchstander to have the first time that they've seen something like this be when there's 9,000 tons of steel hurtling towards you. It's hurtling towards 28,000 tons of steel. You want trainers to be able to do this, and I think that would be a great investment of additional resources that I think should be coming, and that need to be applied to this problem. High fidelity trainers that show and that provide the stress necessary, and that test the communication between bridge and CIC, which in the Fitzgerald, when people talk about readiness and systemic errors, this is one of them. The backup from CIC to the bridge on Fitzgerald was ridiculous. There had to, I mean, it was almost non-existent from what I could see. That's unacceptable. That's a culture on the ship. That's a command team that isn't absolutely requiring that. That's a captain who's not sitting on the bridge and beating people up for combat not making routine reports, of combat not being helpful. You have to do that, and you have to do it under pressure, and you have to do it in a simulator environment. And we quite frankly don't have that right now.
Yeah, let me steal from Sal here a minute. But I was going to ask you about combat, because I, as an old CIC officer and obviously an OOD, where the heck was combat? Where, you know, I always, if I didn't get reports from, I went in there and blew up. What happened here?
What happened was a level of inattention by leadership in CIC that will probably be the purview of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and a failure of the bridge to demand of combat the information and the value added that combat is fully capable of giving. If the bridge isn't asking for it, CIC better be pushing it anyway. And if CIC is not pushing it, the bridge needs to demand it. And I did not see that in the Fitzgerald report. I just did not see that at all. And it's sad. It's a very sad part about reading that.
Yeah, the as inspirational as the damage control and the behavior of the crew after the collision is, it's you need to pour a drink looking at what was happening on the bridge and CIC. And I wanted to ask you a question, Brian. I don't even know whether you can answer it, but it's something that's been bouncing around in my head. And it has to do, if not selection or training or an overall atmosphere, it's really hard, and I think everybody needs to be careful second-guessing every CO in every condition. But there's a commonality in a mindset that I can take. Let's look at the McCain, and I can take it to a different community in a completely unrelated event separated by almost a decade. There's one thing we saw on the McCain was the CO made a decision for reasons that have only been outlined at this point. I'm sure we'll find out more down the road, to delay what should have been seen anchor detail in order to enable rest for his crew. And this took place after the Fitzgerald incident. We don't know how much that informed the decision, if at all. But you see the CO on the bridge, and there's almost an attitude of, I'm the CO, I'm here, nothing can go wrong. And it reminded me of an incident that took place where he had the CO of a special project squadron ran his P-3 off the runway in Afghanistan, and you looked afterwards. Yeah, he was a CO, but he hadn't met his minimum flying requirements in the month, the quarter, or even the year. He was really inexperienced, much less landing high. But he was a CO. It was his plane, and because he was there, he was going to do everything right. And like we saw on the bridge in CIC, there was very little. I know that we had on the McCain where everybody advised against not doing CN anchor detail. But is there something that we do, or just as a natural byproduct of the personality type that succeeds in command, where you can get the feeling that I'm here, I'm alone, and because I'm here, I can make it happen? And how much of that type of mentality as a senior person present may have led to that? And you can also, I think, even though they weren't the CO, the officer at the deck on the Fitzgerald, we had that one person unchallenged, is that critical juncture in a chain of events?
That's a tough question.
Yeah.
And like you, I don't want to. I don't want to slime the CEO of the McCain. I think he made a mistake, a well-intentioned mistake, in not following the advice of the three senior people in his chain of command who deal with seamanship and navigation. There's something meaningful when those three people stack up and say, this is what we think you should do. I got to tell you, I don't know that I will ever again have another job like command of a ship. When you talk to admirals and you ask, I was Admiral Kolaris's aide when he was a 3-star, and we spent time with Admiral Borda when he was Cincus Navier, and we were together for 3 or 4 days. And the thing those two guys talked about more than anything was who was the better destroyer captain. There is something about that, you know, that 05 command that it is a special job, right? Everywhere you go, people are saying attention on deck. If you aren't able to integrate some humility and some sense of self into this incredible position, you can make mistakes. You can make mistakes of assuming too much unto yourself. And that is a dangerous thing. You said something that struck me. You said, you know, the personality that tends to succeed in command. I'm not sure there is one, right? There is a stereotype of the CEO, but I've been around enough people to see that there are, and had enough different CEOs to see that there are different kinds. There are some who are more collegial than others. There are some who are more soft-spoken and introspective. I think what I don't want to do is promote the sense that there really is just sort of one way to do things. There's lots of ways to skin this cat, and I think one way that ought to always be integrated into your command personality is that the ability to examine your own presumptions and the openness to that sort of what the sub-leaders call forceful backup. There was backup here. I don't know how forceful it was. I don't know if it had been more forceful whether the CEO would have said no. As you said, I don't know the degree to which the CEO of the McCain had been socialized by what happened on Fitzgerald, because when Fitzgerald collided, you know, 24 hours after it had gotten underway, the whole world said, oh, my God, this is due to, you know, exhaustion in the surface force. And you got story after story that went out after that pointed to that as a contributing factor in Fitzgerald. So the CEO then says, well, I'm going to give my crew an extra hour of sleep. You can see how that possibly played in. I feel that it's hard in that job not to get that sense that, you know, you're infallible, but it is probably the number one thing you have to guard against in order to ensure that your ship can operate safely.
Yeah, I have a question too, which is based on my very small world of experience, but some of the best CEOs I ever had on board ship had been had commands, smaller commands, minesweepers or diesel boat submarines, before they came to the ship that I was on with them, and that experience they had, I think really tempered their, in my view, really tempered their way they approached being in command. Is there an argument to be made that nobody should become CEO of one of our major ships without having first been CEO or OIC of a smaller ship, sort of like the Coast Guard model, where you kind of work your way up from the smaller boats to the major commands?
You know, that's interesting that you say that, because I would like to see the data. I would like to see the surface force do some looking at this. I would suggest that your likelihood of being relieved in command as an O5 is just as high if you had junior command as it was if you didn't. I don't believe that the data supports your suggestion. I can't say for sure, but I read a lot of these reports, and I find myself thinking, that's a guy that didn't listen to his XO. And oftentimes it's because the guy wasn't an XO. He was never an XO. He doesn't understand what it's like to have sat in that chair. Now, the Surface Force, to some extent, solved that problem by doing XO to CO fleet up. I think it created other problems with XO to CO fleet up. But I would actually like to see that data. I don't know whether it's supported. And there were, you know, let's face it, in the old days when you had a bazillion ships, there were all kinds of opportunities for command earlier. And so I don't know whether that was just happenstance that led you to have the experience you did, or whether it's supported by data. I just don't know.
Well, Brian, that's been, wow, a quick hour. And I think you already look at the reports that's been generated on this topic. We could spend hours talk on it, but I really appreciate you taking time on today to talk with us about what we've seen so far this summer. And as we close things up, what do you recommend that the listener keep an eye open for from Big Navy with regard to follow-on actions resulting from what we've seen with the collisions recently? And also, outside of that, what are you working on right now? And if people want to keep track of you, what's the best way for them to do that?
Okay. I think that the proof will be in the fiscal year 19 budget. And if there are, if money moves in the direction of that helps plus up manning in the Western Pacific, that helps move money into the PEO that provides bridge equipment and standardization. If you see money going into CNET's lines, the Chief Naval Education and Training, who ultimately has to resource a lot of the training, I will be convinced that it's serious if money moves in 19. Now, that's kind of a problem because the 19 budget planning is happening right now. That's what I would be. I would look for actual money moving in 19. What am I working on right now? The thing I'm working hardest on right now is an article that describes what a lot of people have been talking about with respect to a combat system of systems that links surface ships together with unmanned aerial vehicles and high-performance fighters and airborne early warning in a true combat system rather than an architecture that we just sort of kludge together a bunch of individual combat systems. That's really what I'm thinking about and deeply cogitating on and writing about right now. And I think the best place to find out what I'm doing is to follow me on Twitter at conswahoo, conswahoo, because I do my snarky stuff there, and I also point at my professional stuff there.
Absolutely. That's how I spy on you, Brian. And again, great information, and I know we've got some smart people who are looking at that, and hopefully we'll make our Navy better because of it.
I hope so, too. Thank you, fellas.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Brian. It's been great talking to you today.
And thank you very much for joining us for another live edition of Midraps, and hope to see you next time. And until then, I hope you have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary. The sweetest girl I know. Goodbye.
Oh,